Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Should I give you that chronological thing and then you can cut down what you need?
Sure. You can summarize.
But. Yeah. My name is Ian Heath. I live in Redmond, Washington. So I spent about 28 years in the software business as a software engineer.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect from KNKX. And I'm in Ian Heath's workshop overlooking Lake Sammamish.
I spent some time at Visio, downtown Seattle. Had a couple of small, unsuccessful stints at Microsoft. My longest engagement was at Tableau Software in Fremont, where I was about 9 years. And as one of the earlier employees, I was very fortunate. They were paying me more in stock than in salary. So in 2013, we took the company public. At that point, I had the opportunity to not have to do a 9-to-5 job anymore. And it's funny, I remember talking to my manager at the time, who was also one of the earlier employees. I told him that I was going to leave. And I said to him, I wonder if there'll be an exodus. Do you think you'll leave? And he said, I don't know. I don't know what I would do with myself. And I realized that a lot of people, their job defines who they are. And for me, as a sort of a creativity junkie with loads of hobbies, I knew there was stuff I had to do. I had a list of things I wanted to do, and I didn't need a 9-to-5 job to keep me occupied. I knew I would find ways to amuse myself.
Like small round flat bricks and 1x2 bricks and some specialized bricks.
I decided to focus on becoming a Lego artist. Everything is awesome. My specialty is building characters out of Lego. A lot of Lego artists focus on vehicles and landscapes and buildings because Lego is a kind of rectilinear medium. I decided that...
Wait a minute, it's a kind of what?
A rectilinear medium. It's very blocky, so people tend to build buildings. So I decided to focus on building characters and organic things and creatures, which seemed like a much more interesting challenge. I'd had some success. My first custom model was a little model of Stephen Hawking, which surprisingly went viral and is still very much, it's being discovered to this day by people for the first time.
So, okay, this is the famous Stephen Hawking model right there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Stephen Hawking sitting in his specialized wheelchair with his speech device and so on. So there's a few details of this. Can I touch it? Mm-hmm. The thing that I found interesting and compelling about this is the posture of mm-hmm. things like the legs. Stephen Hawking, if you look at a picture of him as he sits, his knees are a little bit off to the side and his legs are a little bit slanted. It's not all right angles like you typically might get with mm-hmm. with Lego. And so how did you do that?
It's just like a form of sculpture. And I tried to get things as accurate to the reference material, the images I'm working from. Yeah, so with the Stephen Hawking model, you have this very rectangular chair, which is all right angles and very, very mechanical, but you have this frail, twisted person inside, and that really helps the viewer engage with it because it looks like lifelike. So for me, it's a very iterative process. The first pass I do of a model looks terrible, but it looks like it's been just cut out of stone, and then I just keep carving away edges and rebuilding parts of it to make it more faithfully represent the thing I'm trying to copy. I don't like to accumulate bricks indefinitely, so once I've shown a model at a couple of shows, I destroy it. I keep a few that are my favorites, but the rest ultimately get ground down and sorted back into the collection.
So now that you're a full-time and rather renowned Lego artist, can you imagine going back to work full-time in software?
I really cannot. I do miss the job sometimes, some aspects of it, and I certainly miss my Tableau family and the community I built there, and I was very proud of what I did. But I derive enormous satisfaction from my Lego projects. So I'm kind of a failed artist, something of a creativity junkie. So I've always had hobbies which involve making things. And I just, up here in my little nest, I can, see the world go by, and I just have music playing in the background, and I'm just in kind of my happy place, just producing art.
This week on Sound Effect, our theme is Off the Job. Stories of people making a break with their old gigs and what comes after. That's ahead on today's show from KNKX. Sarah Jamshidi lives in Seattle, and she runs a news organization called Goltoon News. It covers fashion, but it's pretty unique. Goltoon is all about modest fashion for Muslim women. So this hasn't always been Sarah's work. She used to be a newspaper reporter in Iran, but a series of events there forced her to leave her career behind, events that can be traced back to 1979 when Sarah was a child. That's when her country's government was overthrown during the Iranian Revolution. Sound effect contributor Janae Janik has the story.
Sarah remembers the revolution as an intense time, with lots of shouting and noise in the streets. And then the new fundamentalist government created laws telling women what they could or could not wear.
Before 1979, my mom didn't used to wear a scarf or a hijab. She could go outside with mini skirt. But after the revolution, everything changed. The government really wanted to control the society. So they made into the law for women to cover. I didn't put on hijab or a scarf up until when I was 15. And I knew that I had to put on manteau, it's a big robe, and scarf. And I was thinking, damn, this is not right. Because outside in the summer, men do not have to cover. They do not have to put scarf. They do not have to have long sleeves. Why should I? Girls in my age, 15, 16, 17, rebellious, we had ponytail on our head, and then the scarf was just barely covering any hair, and we had a very, very tight manteau or robe, so you could see so many shape, and we would have like nail polish. The whole idea was really showing the middle finger to the authority and tell them, hey, you are not in charge of our body and our future. We had morality police on the streets. And one time I remember I was wearing sunglasses my mom brought me. And then the morality police, she stopped me. She started asking questions. And before I know, she just took me to a building. They put me into a dark room and they started questioning about my whereabouts, why I wore those sunglasses. So my uncle had to bail them to take me out.
Sarah decided something needed to be done to change these laws. So she became a journalist. She wrote articles about what it means to be a woman and the struggles of growing up in a conservative Muslim country.
According to the Constitution, I was free to write about the subjects, and the government was free to do whatever. Yeah, it was just a joke between the reporters that you can write whatever you want and the government does whatever they want with you. It was the same time when the chain killing happened. So many of the oppositions against the government and dissidents were killed in their houses. I was working for Jame newspaper when Mr. Safwari Harandi was arrested in the newsroom.
Can you just describe what that was like for you to watch your editor be arrested right in front of you? Because he was your editor, correct?
Yeah, it was horrible. Okay, I don't know. So basically the head of the newspaper, Mr. Harandi, he came back to the newsroom, and two people were waiting for him outside to take him to a Vin News prison. I saw him. He was coming down the stairs. And then he just left the paper. And it was, I mean, at the time, many of us knew that this might be our futures, so to speak. We wanted freedom and we wanted to have the government to be responsible and accountable for what he was doing. And many of us thinking that our life is a price, very costly price, but a price that we were willing to pay. It was the time when I was receiving threatening letters about throw acid in your face, we are gonna kill you, we are gonna kidnap you. It was the time when the reporters were kidnapped on the streets. And my friend in the intelligence services, covering intelligence services, told me that they have this list called blacklist or red list. The blacklist is for the people or opposition who are writing or doing things the government doesn't really appreciate. So he told me that my name has gone up the list. And one day I was talking with my friend Afsane on my land phone in my dad's house, and I started hearing the coughing sound. So I asked Afsane, is someone is listening to us? And she said, no, there is no one in my house. On the receiver, I said, I know you are listening to us. Tell me who you are. And the person on the phone said, you need to be careful. It was a male, a very heavy voice. So I knew that they are after me.
The death threats, the phone tapping, even her editor's arrest didn't faze her. She wrote for several publications and eventually for Zan newspaper. Zan was founded in 1998 by the former president's daughter. It was the first Iranian newspaper both run by and focusing on women. But less than a year later, the government banned the paper entirely. It was only then that Sarah realized what she was up against.
I thought if the authority allows itself to close down the paper of the president's daughter, they would allow themselves to do anything. 10 months later, 20 publications got shut down in one day. Seven of them, we were working in the same newsroom, they were imprisoned. Yeah, it was serious.
She decided to leave. Her boyfriend was living in Seattle, so she made plans to try and meet him there. The only problem? There were more than 300 people interviewing to get a visa. Only three were available. Somehow, Sarah got one of them.
I was very happy that I got the visa, I was able to leave the country, because honestly, if you were targeted by the government, the whole family is targeted, so to speak. And I was so relieved that at least my family is left alone.
Was it hard to leave your family not knowing when you would see them again?
I was just thinking, what am I doing here? I don't speak the language. No one knows me. There is no way I can make it. There were so many times when I was taking the classes at UW and going back to Suzulu library and sitting there just crying for 2 hours straight, for 3 hours straight, thinking that, oh my God, this is so difficult, the language is so difficult. And I just kept praying, kept asking God to give me guidance and to just help me to become somehow better than what it was when I started the journey.
What was it like to be a journalist here in America versus over in Iran?
Anytime I open my mouth, so you're from Iran, you're covered, aren't you? And the perception right after that was you're oppressed. And this really bugged me. And I thought, how can I show a larger picture?
Sarah made it her mission to fight against the stereotypes of Muslim women in English language media. But she hadn't yet discovered what would come to be her unique contribution to that mission. That emerged one evening during Ramadan, the holy month when many Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset. There was a huge gathering, maybe 600 people, and Sarah had never seen anything like it.
If I was in Iran, I would see only women in specific colors, specific clothes, black or dark, and women usually always scarf. But here in the United States, they are just wearing beautiful, beautiful dresses. I was just so amazed, mind-blowing, at the same time, very disturbing to see that there was no news coverage. And I thought, I really need to do something about this. We started writing about stories about Muslim women. Clothes, I think, and dress is one way of explaining an aspect of what's important to you. In the Western society, Muslim women has always been criticized for what they wear and how they carry themselves. I found this very troubling, and with GoTo News, we are just reporting on that.
What does it mean for you to be an Iranian American Muslim woman and a journalist at that today?
We inherited the U.S. Constitution, a beautiful literature, rich writing about what it means to be a free person. I read the Constitution 3 times. I think the founding fathers really thought about the process of what it means to be a foreigner, what it means coming from a different land, what it means to hold principles and ideas. Democracy is in the blood and nature of this culture and this nation. And I think we as nation prevail, and we as nation are able to hold up to the democracy that the Constitution and our founding fathers has given us.
Sarah hasn't been back to Iran since she left. She says it's too dangerous. 2 of her friends returned and were arrested at the airport. For now, she stays in touch with family through Skype and meets up with relatives in other countries. Because of the Trump administration's travel policy, her family cannot visit her in the United States.
That story from sound effect contributor Janae Janik. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is off the job. Some people report to work purely for the paycheck. For others, it's more than a job. It's part of who they are. Gregory Blackstock is a man who knows both of those experiences. If you were to chart his career path, it would go something like this. Dishwasher, 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 internationally renowned artist. Gregory is famous for drawing collections of objects like trains, crows, airplanes. Even when he just writes a list of words, there's something about the way they end up on the page that makes you want to look at them. Sound effect producer Jennifer Wing introduces us to Gregory and to the woman in his life who makes it possible for him to succeed in a world that, at first, neither of them knew anything about.
Before meeting 72-year-old Gregory Blackstock, I am prepared for this encounter by his cousin, Dorothy Frisch.
He's loud. He's big. He talks a lot. He wants an audience for the things that he talks about. So if you're in the room with him, he will corner you and talk for ever about what's interesting to him. There's no back and forth or give and take in a conversation.
Hi, Greg.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Let's see if these are the right cookies that you like.
Yep.
Oh, good.
Gregory Blackstock is autistic. His home is a small apartment in an assisted living facility in the Northgate neighborhood of Seattle. And on this day, what he wants to show us and talk about is a clip from the 1962 film It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And he's especially taken with the character Mrs. Marcus, who's played by Ethel Merman.
It's a mad world. How does Ethel Merman sound to you?
Loud.
In the country, drive on, you big stupid idiot.
Those are pretty harsh words, aren't they?
Yeah, but I like them in the movie, so.
Gregory Blackstock, or Greg, as his cousin Dorothy calls him, has been labeled a genius and a savant. He speaks multiple languages he's learned over the years by listening to lessons on his record player. He plays the accordion, and he is a gifted artist whose drawings sell for thousands of dollars and are in collections all over the world. Greg adores Dorothy, and he knows that his current life would not be possible without her.
Do you mind if I ask you what you love about your cousin Dorothy?
Mostly, getting me into world famous artistry is the main thing.
That was a very, very important part of your life, too.
I needed that.
Why'd you need it?
I just want, main thing, I just want to get away from drudgery. I'm in a food and beverage business. I have to do drudgery all the time.
Before becoming a world-famous artist, Greg worked for decades as a dishwasher at the Washington Athletic Club in downtown Seattle. It was a place that treated him very well, but it was also a place he was happy to leave.
And now you can support yourself with your art. That's a pretty amazing thing after you retired from all that drudgery. That's very special, Greg. Not everybody gets to have a job that they love after a job that they didn't love.
Inside his apartment is a drafting table where he works. A bookcase is filled with volumes that have titles like Guide to Wildflowers of North America, Parrots of the World, Birds of Europe, and Dangerous Marine Mammals. He devours these books and catalogs what he learns onto paper. Dorothy unrolls one of the drawings Greg is working on.
Ooh, what is it?
Ooh.
Greg, can you read the title for her out loud?
Yeah, the Great World Moths.
The Imperial Moth and the White Witch Moth. Wow.
His freehand images are neatly lined up on paper. They're often in color and outlined with black marker. They look like carved block prints. In this style, he has drawn birdwing butterflies, leghorn roosters, aphids, even outboard motor racing boats.
He has never drawn the third parrot from the left on his parrot drawing. That's the first time he's ever tried it. And it's on the finished drawing. His drawing is very static on the page, but it's very lifelike to him. He recently did a drawing of grizzly bears in different colors. He will walk around the room and do a fierce grizzly bear growl that he picked up from a old Disney television show about wildlife.
I'm just getting up close to him here.
I want to stay pretty far from grizzly bears, that's for sure.
Today, Dorothy is Greg's official guardian, but it didn't start out this way. In the 1970s, when Dorothy was heading out into the world excited to build an adult life, Greg's mother wanted to groom Dorothy to be Greg's caretaker.
I was kind of watching him from the sides all the time saying, he's not my problem, he's not my problem, he's not my problem. But of course, I inherited him because there was nobody else.
Greg's parents were dead. His only sibling, his brother, also died. Dorothy knew that if she didn't embrace this responsibility, which she had held at arm's length for so long, that her cousin would end up on the streets.
He could so easily be homeless. And he would look just like the kind of homeless people that we all walk by and say, oh, you know, somehow that must be his fault or her fault that they're homeless. But he would have just plain run out of money and not have had any way to generate any more income.
The first time Gregory showed that he had a knack for drawing was years ago in the early 1970s when his mom was still alive. He drew a collection of tools on paper and showed it to his mother.
And she said, oh, it's great, but it's too big. I don't know how big of an impact that had, but he waited another at least 10 years before he started doing anything else.
When he did pick up a pen again, nothing stopped him.
Something in his soul would wither if he did not have the ability to put on paper what he wants.
The Washington Athletic Club, where Gregory washed dishes, put his drawings in its newsletters. And then one day, Dorothy's neighbor saw Greg's work in one of these mailings.
And this fellow was also an artist, and he said, oh, wow, this is great stuff. There's a name for this and a big market called Outsider Art. And I just said, well, that's just crazy. Coming late to the party, my understanding is that an outsider artist is making art for his or her own particular enjoyment and not at all for an audience. So I looked up and found an outsider art gallery in Seattle. I put together a cover letter, a packet of everything I could find that I'd saved from Gregory, and I sent it to them. And I didn't hear anything. Months and months and months and months later, they called. They had to see Greg. They had found that manila envelope behind a file cabinet and didn't know it was there until they moved. And then they opened it this up. Finding a treasure trove of undiscovered art was very much like Christmas morning for them.
Greg had his first art show a few months later. The first drawing to be purchased went for $750. Today, a collection of his work is published in a book. His drawings are turned into fancy puzzles and note cards sold in art museum gift shops. But here's the thing. Greg doesn't care about the money. It means nothing to him. What does matter are the compliments he gets from people. And he wants to know where in the world his work is on display. Despite his success, Dorothy worries about her cousin every day. When he leaves his apartment, people don't see a famous artist. What strangers see is a large, disheveled man who sometimes bumps into people without apology, a man who has a difficult time following instructions, and who is curiously drawn to people in law enforcement.
When we go through TSA at the airport, he always makes sure he salutes everybody there. How are you doing, officer? But he cannot obey verbal instructions to put his hands over his head so they can go through the scanner. Imagine if he's out on the street and somebody says, put your hands up or put your hands behind your back or something like that. He can't do it. But on the flip side of that, people are always surprising me with their kindness.
Wherever Greg goes, the bus, the library, restaurants, his regular haunts, people know who he is, and they look out for him.
He has little angels all over the city. Greg, we gotta go. I've gotta drop this off at the front desk. Do you want me to get rid of this box for you so it's not in your way? You're not gonna use it, right?
Trash!
But you're still... Greg is extremely happy. Most of us would look at him and say, oh, that's really a shame. You know, he's got this debilitating mental illness. He looks like a dumpster fire. It's just too bad. But you could take 10 people at random and they're all less happy than him.
And what do you take from that observation?
Well, those lessons are hard to learn. I guess it would be to not put my own values on what a life well lived has to look like.
As we say our goodbyes, Greg turns into an airplane. This is what he does when he's happy.
Okay.
Here we go now.
I'm gonna go.
He's an airplane.
Oh, you're an airplane. Okay.
Dorothy says her cousin's success with her as a bridge to the art world, as his guardian, makes her look at other vulnerable people living on the streets, a path that could have easily been Greg's. And she wonders to herself, what incredible talents do these men and women possess that we may never have the pleasure of knowing?
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, our theme is Off the Job. Here's a question. When you were a kid, and you first started listening to music, did you dream of being in a rock band? Like, who didn't, right? For me, it was Guns N' Roses. Growing up on Mercer Island, Mark Rose was captivated by rock and roll. And like most kids, he wanted to be a part of it. But unlike most kids, Mark did end up in the music business. And like a lot of rock and roll stories, Mark's had a burnout ending that left him picking up the pieces of his life. But at the beginning, there was just the music.
And so I was 8 years old, and I got to see the Beatles, and I looked at the spectacle of this thing. And I knew right then and there I was going to become a promoter. I don't know if I knew what that word was, but I looked down at the Beatles. Nobody on that tour, nobody in the audience has ever heard a thing, because the screams were so loud and the PAs were so small. There wasn't one song you ever heard. And I thought, I don't think I'll ever be able to write songs like that. You know, I don't know if I'll ever be able to grow bangs like that or look good in Beatle boots. So I want to be the guy in the short sleeve, you know, arrow shirt, the clip-on black tie with a clipboard telling everyone what to do, how to make this happen.
As you were getting more and more serious about music management and promotion and actually getting into that line of work, what was going on in your life besides that, in your personal life?
I would drink with the goal of passing out on a Friday and Saturday night, and then I'd hold off during the week because I had to go to school. And then once I got into the music business, at about age 19, I could see that these people, these touring, you know, managers and some of the groups and things are you know, this is the late 70s, are using cocaine. And I thought, well, that's probably the way to go.
Who were some of the musicians you worked with at that time?
It was just about every single musician, you know, you and I ever knew from the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it was Van Halen and the Kinks and Rodney Dangerfield and Neil Diamond and, I don't know, ZZ Top and Heart.
What is unique about drug and alcohol use in that kind of a social setting as compared with what most civilians encounter?
You know, for them to go up on stage in front of 10,000, 20,000, 75,000 people a night and get that accolade, it's not really easy to kind of calm down after that, or to have that expectation of playing over and over again in front of, you know, big audiences. You know, they, you know, there can be a tendency to turn to drugs.
How did you come to think of this as a problem that needed to be addressed in your own life rather than just a fact of life?
It was due to my tolerance. I was in my early 40s, and one day I woke up, or I came to, and my tolerance had gone from these planning stages where I would say, okay, I'm going to start taking drugs and alcohol at, you know, 6 or 7 at night, and then I'll pass out by this time. I'll be ready for the next day. Well, that tolerance had moved down to the noon hour, and I thought, this is insanity. I need help, so I got to go. I have to go check myself into one of these treatment centers. And back then, the only image I had of a treatment center was from the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
So what was your experience of treatment like?
It was the greatest, most profound experience of my life. My 28th day came up. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to, like, live there and learn how to talk to people without judging them and shaming them, or these things that I had the ability to do at one time. And it was just a fantastic experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
As you were kind of figuring out who you were without the drugs and alcohol, as you were kind of pulling these fragments of your identity back together, what was that like and what did you find?
It was terrible. That first year, I was working at DreamWorks Records as a promotion and marketing manager, and I went back to work right away. And I had this fantastic toolbox before I got sober for doing business, and that was to lie and to be angry and to throw something against the ground or wall, you know, if I wasn't getting my way. It was like a petulant child, and most of us in the music business were like that. And I kind of learned these things in treatment, like, you know, listen to people, compassion, you know, empathy. And so ultimately, after about 6 months of that, I didn't know how to be in the world.
How did you figure out what your next chapter was going to be like if you weren't going to be working in the music business?
I had a little private plan in my head, which I don't think was that great, and that was to go get this degree, get good at it,
And when you say it, you're talking about counseling or?
Yeah, drug and alcohol addiction counseling. To get that degree, to get my certificate, to get my license, go to LA and move there and be addiction counselor to the stars, you know. And once I was kind of getting near the end of school, I got a job offer to work there in the Midwest at Hazelden. And so I worked for a few years with adult women in a 28-day inpatient. And God, if you had told me 2 years before you'd be a counselor working with adult women and in the Midwest, I'd say, here, let's get you into treatment. So it was an incredible experience, and that's how I got started.
And you still work with musicians, right?
I do. I do down at the Musicians Union for anybody that's struggling, whether it's roadies, you know, or musicians or managers or whatever, because there is that extra layer of challenge, I think, that comes with being a musician. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, some musician coming into my group that just plays three nights a week in a local band, but usually they're playing in bars. You know, how do we create more, you know, coping skills for that and ways out of that so that they can still play their music? So,
do you think that there are skills or experiences that you bring from your first career that help you in your current role as a counselor?
I think so. I think it really stems back to when I was first starting in the music business, and I'm about 18 or 19, and I'm working at the Paramount, and the, you know, the promoter would say, Mark, you know, here's the keys to the van, go to the airport and pick up this group. And it happened early on. I'd pick up these artists that were always kind of disheveled, you know, or couldn't really shake a hand, you know, firmly, things like that. And I always thought, not always, but early on, I thought, you know, these guys aren't that friendly. I don't really dig them that much. But then I realized they're in a different world. And so I learned to relate to them, relate to art. I love artists. And I think that's helped me in this career, to be able to really be an active listener. And you know, sometimes I've heard people talking about music where sometimes you listen in between the notes and you can hear things. And to be able to listen to what they're really saying, what they're really trying to say about themselves, and to understand them and to have empathy and caring for them. I think I brought that over from working with those early artists that were true artists. Yeah.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming in and telling us
your story.
You're welcome. Mark L. Rose, he runs Mark L. Rose Intervention and Therapy, and he lives in Seattle. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Check 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I'm going to have this contraption right about here. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Off the Job. A quick heads up that this next piece includes some disturbing accounts of abuse that might not be appropriate for some listeners.
It's just that whenever I see a microphone, I want to make noises in it.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Wes Browning. I work at Real Change. I've been working at Real Change since, as a volunteer or as staff, since 1994 when we started.
Wes Browning has mischievous eyes and a white beard. And if you've never picked up a copy of Real Change, it's a weekly newspaper sold on the street by vendors, usually people experiencing homelessness. Wes helps manage the vendors, writes a regular column, and frequently contributes art. But this isn't where Wes's career began. For that, we go back to the 1970s at Cornell University in New York State. Do you want to take a crack at explaining what your research was about?
Oh, boy. There's a thing called the projective plane. The idea is two complexes are more complicated than surfaces because...
Let me explain this in simple layman's terms. You got two homotopic complexes with the same uric characteristic, provided it satisfies the Eichler condition. All right, I have no idea what this means, actually. Browning trained as a theoretical mathematician, and this is the world he ran in.
I love that it's possible to just study something, and suddenly realize, oh, my God, there's some pattern here, there's something, things that should fall into place a certain way, and then find out you're right. It feels a little bit like hunting. I mean, I've never hunted myself, but I've seen animals hunt. And I feel like, you know, a coyote stalking a rat. I feel like a hawk swooping down on a rabbit, because you've got something. There's something there. You see something moving, and you go to it, and you track it. And if it's something you can carry, you get it. That's all. It's the thrill of the chase, and what you're chasing is ideas in your own head, really. My father and I had not spoken in years and years and years. When I went back to Seattle, I got together with my parents and sort of buried the hatchet with him. He finally understood what I was doing to try to become a professor. He had no idea what a math degree was for. Now he understood it. And a few months after I got there, he died. I was, you know, it didn't mean anything to me at the time. I had no feelings about it. I was numb to it. And then over Christmas break, I just lost it. And I started having a panic attack. I never had a panic attack before. I was starting to have panic attacks just going to work. And then right after I did, I found that I couldn't do any more research. And it just was untenable after a while. I just couldn't take it. I had three papers written. It was going to be a while before they could be revised for publication. And I couldn't sit down and revise them, because every time I try to sit down, I'd start having another panic attack. So realizing that I couldn't publish the papers, I had 50 copies made of each one, and I mailed the 50 copies off to the names of the people in the bibliography.
Browning tried another teaching gig that didn't work out. Then he came to Seattle, where he taught in a series of community colleges. But still, debilitating anxiety kept him from succeeding. And on the way, he lost his housing.
I was living in the underground parking garage at Kane Hall. I was not living there exactly. I had a car. I was living out of it. This was the second time I was homeless. Actually, I was homeless before as a graduate student at Cornell. The second time I was homeless, and this was the worst, because I was mentally ill. I started seeing a therapist in 83, and it helped me to understand, especially why the delayed stress syndrome would have been triggered by my father's death. My parents tried to kill me on my first birthday. My father came home, he got in a fight with my mother, dropped me head first on the pavement in the course of the fight, and I had a concussion that looked like it was so bad that he was going to get in trouble with his superiors in the Army. And then they had this idea that they could cover it up by propping me up against a sapling and running over me with the car, which they did. And I was in a coma for 4 months because of this. My mother was really the principal abuser. My father stopped being physically abusive because he saw the light on my fourth birthday. He thought he'd killed me again. So he stopped hitting me. He stopped being physically abusive. And he compensated for that by being verbally abusive, extremely verbally abusive, so verbally abusive that I just couldn't talk to him anymore. I never initiated conversations with him except in emergencies. My mother, on the other hand, she never stopped physically abusing me. And the physical abuse included sexual torture. And my father was, to a large extent, even though we weren't talking, he was the closest thing to the protector that I had. You know, the protector is gone. I just did what everybody said. Everybody says, that's the past, this is the present, just don't think about it. And I did not think about it. I just tried to tell myself that doesn't matter anymore, it's over with. And it can't get to me. And then I found out that, yeah, it can. It can get to you when you're least expecting it, and it just comes, all these feelings just come back up again. I was always missing the math. It was very painful for me, especially when I quit teaching. It was painful to separate from a career like that. Not being able to do research was painful. It was like, it was over with. Like, yeah, I wanted to go back to it. I was Googling myself back in 1999 when the internet was new, and it wasn't even Google, it was Yahoo. And I was just doing an internet search to find my own research, because I did do that thing. I sent out 50 copies of those papers.
Like 20 years earlier.
Yeah, and I thought maybe somebody's done something with it. I was hoping this. What my biggest fear was I'd send this out and everybody just languished in people's desks or something, and eventually end up in the trash, and I would have done all that for nothing. So I wanted to see if anybody had done something along the lines of what I did, and I wasn't really too concerned whether I got credit, but in fact I found my name attached to my results.
Unbeknownst to Wes, in those decades since he last dipped a toe in math, his ideas had taken root. The Browning obstruction theorem. Remember all that stuff about homotopic groups and whatnot? It was now a thing.
I found it as the Browning obstruction theorem among the titles of a conference. So I looked at the person's name that was going to give the talk, and I looked him up. Contacted him, and he was very excited and said he'd made his career out of my work. So I was really just thrilled to death.
Wes Browning is a writer, speaker, and artist in Seattle. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Bethany Denton, Jenny Janik, Bellamy Palethorpe, Aaron Hennessy, and Kari Ploeg. Our intern is Max Wasserman, and Matt Martinez is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else you get your audio, including your smart speaker. Just say, play the podcast Sound Effect. And for the next 4 weeks, we're going to be doing something fun. Each week, a different Sound Effect producer will take over the show and bring you some of their favorite stories that they've worked on in one way or the other over the years. We start next week when we let producer Kevin Kniestead take over the host chair, if you can believe it. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.